you and good morning. We've heard about women, children, child care providers, people with substance abuse, and people who need medication. And the running theme is, in addition to the problems that these folks are having, they may also have an additional problem, that's legal issues. So what we're going to do to wrap up this program is talk about newcomers who have all the issues that you've heard. In addition, they have the legal problems. So for my 7.5 minutes, I'm going to give a quick overview of immigration. I'm smushing into 7.5 minutes what I do in a 14-week course. Then I'll turn it over to my colleague, Dr. Elaine Congress, who will talk about, against that context of being a newcomer, an immigrant, what are some of the access issues, which you've already heard. We're going to fly through this, so hopefully after my 7.5 minutes, you'll know the difference in terminology, what's a green card, an immigrant, a refugee, et cetera, and then turn it over to Elaine Congress to talk about some of the health access issues. So just to give you an overview, this is the way the immigration law is structured. People can come in for a short term. They can come to your offices if you're a direct social worker, direct service social worker. People can come into the country for a long term, and a code word or a synonym for that is getting a green card. People will never come to your office because there are reasons to exclude you. And once here, people can be deported. The fancier word is removed. And at the end of the line, if there's no problem, you can become a U.S. citizen. And then Elaine will talk about access issues. So taking you back to fifth grade civics class, we have three branches of government, legislative, executive, and judicial. And for purposes of this morning, the legislative branch passes the laws, the Social Security laws, the immigration laws, et cetera. So Congress legislates and the president executes. Before September 11th, the executive branch agency that executed the immigration law was the U.S. Department of Justice Immigration and Naturalization Service. After September 11th, INS was dissolved, and in its stead was born a new ministry or department, the Department of Homeland Security, which took care of immigration. I'm glad that we have a Canadian. In Canada, if you are a foreigner and you have some you want a green card or landed immigrant status, you go to the Ministry of Labor and Migration. In America, if you have a green card issue, you want to get a green card, you go to the Department of Terrorism. So it's a different paradigm shift. It's a different way that we look at foreigners in Canada and in the U.S. So let me run through the different ways that people can come in, and there's 24 ways, but the best, the quickest way is coming in as a visitor or as a student. The letters that you see on the left-hand side are letters that are stamped in foreigners' passports, so that when they arrive at the airport, the customs official sees the letter B and they know that this person's coming in as a visitor. I'm going to run through these and then I'm going to make a quick summary. But these are the main ways that we as clinical workers might see people coming into our offices. And that is as tourists, as students, as the fiancé of a U.S. citizen, mail order brides, as temporary workers. And I mention mail order brides because that has an impact on if you're an abused woman later on. So now we're into week four of my immigration class. And now so people come in for a short term, visitors, et cetera, and they might have all these issues that we have heard, cancer, substance abuse, et cetera, in an overlay is their immigration status. So what if you don't want to go back home after you get your BA at Fordham, after you after you're a nurse in a hospital, that's a temporary worker? What if you want to stay here forever, and that's getting your green card or becoming a lawful permanent resident? These are all synonyms that you might hear. Someone might say, I'm a lawful permanent resident, I have a green card, or I'm an immigrant. It's all the same thing. There are 16 ways, but the three ways that I'm just going to focus on now is the first way to get a green card is if you are sponsored by a family member. So you could be sponsored by your mother, father, brother, sister, husband, wife, or child over 21. Once you get a green card, access issues is no more of a problem. The other way you can get a green card, so I just mentioned that one way you can get a green card is if you're sponsored by your spouse. What if your spouse says, okay, you came from the Philippines, I sponsored you from Poland, I sponsored you from Russia as a mail order bride, and unless you agree to be raped by me or be my slave, I'm not going to go take you to the government office to get a green card. So you're an abused foreign woman. Can you still get a green card? The answer is no. You need a petitioner to get a green card. The exception is, though, that you can self-petition if the U.S. citizen is an abuser, though you have to show some things. The other way that you can get a green card, in addition to being sponsored by a family member, is being sponsored by a job. So we know that there's a shortage of IT workers, shortage of nurses, shortage of a bunch of categories. And if you fit into that category, you can also get a green card. If you don't, however, you can still be undocumented depending on your status. The third way that you can get a green card is if you sponsor yourself by asking for refuge. And the definition of a refugee is this: these paragraphs that you see here gives rise to another 14-week course that I teach, but here I'll give it 30 seconds. A refugee is a person who has a well-founded fear of being persecuted based on their race, religion, nationality, social group, or political opinion. So, hello, I came as a visitor from Mali a month ago. Please do not send me back to Mali because I have a fear of being persecuted based on my social group. My social group is I'm a woman, and if you send me back to Mali, I will undergo female genital mutilation. It's not the soldiers who are doing this to me, it's my grandmother. Let me stay here in Washington, D.C. So that's how you would construct a claim for asylum. From Africa, Latin America, Asia, whatever the last sentence there is, you have to tie persecution to one of those five grounds: race, religion, nationality, social group, or political opinion. Another way that people can get a green card is if they are a juvenile. So you're found in the streets of LA, your mother and father are in Guatemala, you have nobody else. If you get a court order that deems you dependent on the school system, you can then proceed to the next step and get a green card. But first you have to be adjudicated dependent on the system in New York, wherever you're from, and then you go to the INS, which no longer exists. Old people like me, we keep saying INS. You go to DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, and then you say, I've been adjudicated dependent on the system. Give me a green card. So in summary, now we're into week 7 of my course. These are the ways that you can get a green card: being sponsored by a family, by an employer, by applying for yourself for asylum, by applying for yourself because you're an abused person, by applying by being adjudicated dependent on the system, and by entering the lottery, which I'm not going to go into. All right, these are people you're never going to see in your classes, in your social work practice, because these are grounds for excluding people from entering the U.S., and they are based on health-related issues. So if you have HIV, TB, syphilis, gonorrhea, you're not going to be allowed in. If we know that you're a criminal, you're not going to be allowed in. If we know you're a member of Al-Qaeda or the Irish Republican Army, we're not going to let you in. If you appear at the U.S. Embassy in France and you say, I want to go visit the Liberty Bell, and you're in rags, you're poor, they're not going to let you in. If they suspect that you might be coming to the U.S. to get a job and taking it away from a U.S. citizen, you're not going to be allowed in, and so forth. If you're already here, many of us are in academic institutions, and say we have a foreign student in our class. If you fall into any of these categories, these are grounds to deport you. So the first ground of deportation makes reference to all the grounds of exclusion, and it says if there's something about you now that had we known about it would have rendered you excludable, it renders you deportable. So you came in to study biology, an MSW. We didn't know yet you were HIV positive. You are now HIV positive, or you are a terrorist. We now know that you're a member of Al-Qaeda. Of Al-Qaeda, out you go. And again, the second bullet is you've been convicted of a criminal offense, out you go. If you didn't go to the foreign student advisor and register every 6 months like you should have, Mr. Air Pilot person, out you go. If you become poor, out you go. And if we catch you voting, pretending that you're a U.S. citizen, when actually you're a Colombian undocumented person voting for Arnold Schwarzenegger, out you go. Actually, the reason this part of the law was put in is there was a belief in the Republican Party that most foreigners voted Democrat. So 10 years ago, they said if you're an unlawful voter and you're not a U.S. citizen, that's grounds to deport you. All right, and here's the end of my 7.5 minutes. At the end of the line, if somehow you became a lawful permanent resident by being sponsored by a family member, being sponsored by a job, sponsoring yourself because you're an abused person, sponsoring yourself because you've proven that you need refuge, 3 to 5 years later, you can apply to become a U.S. citizen. And to become a U.S. citizen, you have to, you have to be able to speak English, you have to be able to pass a test of American, and number two, pass a test of American civics. So they will ask you questions whose answers you all know. Who is your representative? Who is your senator? What's the 14th Amendment? What's the Second Amendment? Where is your state capital? You know, who represents you in your district? You would all pass this test, I'm sure. So anyway, once you become a U.S. citizen, then everything else falls into place. Then you can apply for the pharmaceutical free drugs. You can apply for Social Security or SSI or Social Security Disability. You can apply for food, cash, and medical assistance, etc. If you're not, if you're undocumented, then you have issues of access, as we have heard. So let me turn it over to Dr. Congress. There you go. Just press the
Hello, everyone. I'm Lynn Congress from Fordham University, and I'm really glad to be here and present on a topic of great interest. This is working now.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
You need to go. Okay. You're going backwards.
Yeah.
You can use the arrow if you want.
Oh. Why am I going? Okay. Okay. And also, if you're interested in finding out more about this, we have a very long, PowerPoint, which we passed out. And we also have copies. We have a forthcoming book on immigration and social work practice, published by Springer, and which you also might want to get more information on. Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about access, because I think we all really know that non-citizen immigrants are much more likely than citizens or U.S.-born to be insured. And we also know there are real differences in terms of Medicaid. We know this is particularly true of immigrant children, and we definitely know what's happening now in the United States in terms of all children many children being uninsured, and this really affects immigrant children and non-documented children. And also, we know that immigrants spend less on health care. I'm not going to go over all of this for the sake of time. Let me just move right along. Thought we'd have more than less. Okay. Basically, what I'm going to talk about is what I see as important issues for social workers. I'm going to talk a bit about public health and social work codes. I'm going to talk about some pre- and post-migration health issues. I'm going to talk a bit about health care disparities and some advocacy efforts. As we all know, this is the APHA conference, and this is one of the priorities of American public health, ensuring access to health care and working on eliminating health disparities. And this is a major issue with immigrants, especially undocumented immigrants. And this is also a few years ago. As you may know, the social work section of American Public Health Association developed what we call social work competencies, and I'm not going to read through the whole thing, but basically it's really important for our purposes, assuring all persons in the target population have access to health care and social services. So it's very much part of what we considered a social work competency. Now I want to talk a bit about the NASW Code of Ethics, which I'm certainly very familiar with. And one of the important values has to do with social justice. And we really stress about social workers working to ensure access to needed information, services, and resources. And of course, that includes immigrants and non-documented people. I want to just share with you, I'm on the national board of NASW, and I've been involved in a special presidential initiative, and I'm involved on a subcommittee working on immigration issues. And one of the things that we've done, and I'm sorry I didn't bring any copies with me today, but you can get it through NASW, we've developed an immigrant toolkit resource because we found that many social workers don't really know enough about this issue. And so this is something that we've worked on developing. Also, something else which I'm really pleased, there's nothing in the Code of Ethics specifically about immigration status, but I'm happy to report that You may be familiar with this, and this is about discrimination and the whole list of different areas, race, ethnicity, national origin, color, sex, sexual orientation, age, marital status, political belief, religion, or mental and physical disability. Something that was just introduced into the national board and approved unanimously, and now it goes to the delegate assembly for the final approval, but is to add immigration status. In other words, social workers will really act to prevent discrimination against anyone because of his or her immigration status. So this is kind of hot off the press, and stay tuned, but I'm sure that hopefully tell your delegates who are going to the assembly next summer in Washington to be sure to vote for this. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about kind of healthcare needs of immigrants, and we can often look at this kind of as pre-migration healthcare issues and healthcare issues when people come. And I'm not going to kind of go through this one by one, but these are some risks for disease of people before they come. But also, this is risk after they come. You know, and this is the United States. This is a real developed country. We're supposed to have wonderful, health care. And you can see, like, a real similarity. Not identical, but real similarity. Now, let me just speak about especially the nutritionally based disease like obesity and diabetes. And as you may know, this is a major issue now. And sometimes the children of immigrants are less healthy than immigrants, you know, which is, we think it's almost counterintuitive. We think people coming from countries which didn't really have health care, that they would really be in poor health, but often their children, because their children are really suffering from obesity and diabetes and other diseases. Also, let me just mention mental health disorders, and this also is a big factor sometimes with immigrants and children of immigrants, and often because people are non-insured, undocumented people, they're not able to get health care for this. Now also, I mean, I've been very interested in this, is how our ideas about health and illness may really differ from kind of immigrants' ideas. And I think part of it, we really focus a lot on prevention. And I know many immigrants say, well, I'm not sick. Why should I go to the doctor? Well, we have a whole focus on prevention. And certainly we know it's very difficult navigating, health care. It's difficult if you're college or graduate school educated. And imagine if you're not really fluent in English or not really fluent in any written language, even if things are translated into Spanish or Mandarin or what have you. But I found many people really are virtually illiterate in any language. Now, this is like our mantra, if you will, of public health professionals, is health promotion and disease prevention. But many immigrants live in really poor areas and really don't have access to fresh food and food with good nutritional value. One of my colleagues at Fordham took a picture of a neighborhood, kind of an aerial view of a neighborhood in East Harlem, and, I mean, it was full of fast food stores, right, and a liquor store, and I think there was even a big cigarette ad, and there was one place that said, there was this old sign that said fresh fruit and vegetable, but that was boarded up, closed, and I mean, I guess bought by someone else probably for a McDonald's. But I think this is really true. Talked about a lot of this. Access is a big issue. Knowledge about available resources, language barriers, and informed consent. And how much do immigrants and children of immigrants really kind of know and understand, and are they really able to really exercise informed consent in terms of medical treatment? Now, just some ethical guidelines having to do with communication, having to do with education and use of cultural brokers, and not just only in working with immigrants, but also working with other health team members who may not be as, you know, knowledgeable about immigrant issues, and, you know, empowerment and advocacy. Now, I've also tried to think about this in terms of micro, mixo, and macro strategies. Number one, you know, in direct practice, can educating clients about their rights, and there's a lot of fear about disclosure now with the Department of Homeland Security and what this will mean. I mean, I'm happy to report, I come from New York City, that there's an executive order in which immigrants do not have to disclose their immigration status to, like, public sector workers. And that is really related to them getting benefits. So, I mean, this is positive, but perhaps doesn't go as far as it should. And New York City may be somewhat in the foreground because this is certainly being challenged in a lot of other places. In New York State, our governor tried to put forth something that that people could get driver's license regardless of their, you know, of whether they were citizens. And that's really been challenged. And now there's talk about a three types of licenses being the last one only for undocumented people. And so it was really concerned that that would really kind of stigmatize them and mark them and really make them, I'm sorry, man? Right, make them very, you know, but also kind of make them very, very vulnerable to the Homeland Security people. Okay, agency practice is important to work with others and to educate them about immigrants and immigrant issues, to hire bilingual and bicultural staff. And it's a real challenge, especially in New York City, but probably many places of the country, is not only to hire people who speak Spanish. I mean, you know, I think in New York City, the ACS, the Administration of Children's Services, has language available, about 100 different languages, like, available, and that shows some of the challenges of hiring bilingual, bicultural staff. And macro practice, certainly initiatives of government, I mean, to try to contact legislators to deal with this on a city level, on a state level, and on a national level. And last but not least, to collaborate with other organizations involved with immigrant rights. Thanks to Fernando, we have a number of different resources that I've included here, and you all have handouts, so you can follow up more on this. So anyway, this is information. If you'd like to get in touch with us, any other questions, comments, and also look more for writing. Our book will be coming out next year, and hopefully be available at the conference next year in San Diego. So, thank you.